You are listening to a free podcast of The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Cedar.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
And I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Wednesday, February 27th, 2013. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Today on the program, somewhat abbreviated program, perhaps, David Dayan, independent journalist, will be on the program to talk about the upcoming sequester and just how much austerity we will be swallowing via the good graces of the deficit hawks, the Pete Petersons, the establishment. You must feel some pain, ladies and gentlemen. But it'll be a slow pain. That is, of course, until we get to the end of March. Will Republicans be forced into a government shutdown showdown? We'll find out. Also on the program today, Bob Woodward learning the lessons from back in the days when he was just a beat reporter trying to uncover Watergate. That is, of course, that when the president does it, it's not illegal. Also on the program today, the libertarians who call on this program seem to have found a larger platform. And frankly, have not upgraded their game. We will get into that as well. Just a little housekeeping up front. This will be an abbreviated show. However, for members, we will have a bonus interview for you at the end of the program. I have some, what is it, filial, is it? Spousal duties as the as an expectant father. There are certain things that we must do to prepare for the upcoming, I guess, arrival of that is expected. But first, let's do this Bob Woodward thing. I have a long history of having a problem with Bob Woodward that goes back to his days of cheerleading the strength of the executive in taking us to war in Iraq, despite the fact there was no reason to do so. The musculature of our great President George W. Bush. I can't remember what the book was that he wrote at that time, but it was, I don't know what it was, leadership or strength, or he's so muscular, or did you see that package? I can't remember what the title of it was. So much so that back in the day when I was asked to host a fundraiser for a theater group, in their reading of All the President's Men, which apparently there was a lot of big actors who were there, and I don't know how big they were. Some were a couple of known at that time, others not. We'll put a link up at least to the piece that I think was in Pointer that pointed this out. And I got up to introduce the piece, and Carl Bernstein was there, and I said, it's appropriate that Bob Woodward is not here today, because the Bob Woodward who did that investigation and had that sense of questioning the executive is long disappeared. And I got off the stage, The actors came up for this reading in front of a very crowded room full of people at this fundraiser. And they started in to do the reading of the movie. And Carl Bernstein was playing one of the roles. I can't remember which. And he, the lines came to him about three lines in, and he stopped. And essentially said, I have to disagree with what that guy, meaning me, said at the beginning of this reading. And he, in no uncertain terms, went on to lambast me and praise Bob Woodward to a mostly approving audience. There were some people who appreciated my comments, not that many. Well, Bob Woodward is back, and this is an appearance he made this morning on Joe Scarborough, talking about the president announcing as a result of the sequester, which has cuts across the board, as many of you know, that a aircraft carrier will not be deployed because of these budgetary cuts. Listen to what Bob Woodward here says, okay, in response to the USS Harry Truman, which was supposed to leave for the Persian Gulf, which will remain stateside. Listen to what Bob Woodward has to say here.
Can you imagine Ronald Reagan sitting there and saying, oh, by the way, I can't do this because of some budget document, or George W. Bush saying, you know, I'm not going to invade Iraq because I can't get the aircraft carriers I need, or even Bill Clinton saying, you know, I'm not going to attack Saddam Hussein's intelligence headquarters as he did when Clinton was president because of some budget document under the Constitution. The president is commander-in-chief and employs the force, and so we now have the president going out because of this piece of paper and this agreement. I can't do what I need to do to protect the country. That's a kind of madness that I haven't seen in a long time.
Let me explain to you what that madness is. It is called the Constitution of the United States, wherein Congress has the right to appropriate monies and has the responsibility, the constitutional obligation, to appropriate money. The budget document or agreement that Bob Woodward talks about is also referred to as law. Not just an agreement, not just a piece of paper. It just so happens that laws are written on piece of papers. In that way, he is correct. But the notion that Bob Woodward is criticizing President Obama for not breaking the law, essentially, for being bound by what Congress has voted upon in terms of appropriations, that he is not, and then going on to cite essentially illegal acts by former presidents. I think when he's talking about Reagan, what he's referring to is probably the fact that we weren't supposed to fund the Contras, but did through secret dealings with Iran. I think when he's referring to George Bush saying, I can't go to Iraq because I don't have what I need, as in terms of like an authorization from Congress to wage war. This is the fetishization of the executive power and the fact that President Obama will not override this law. It's just insane. I don't know what personal issues Bob Woodward has with the administration. I don't care. But this guy is a scourge. And I don't know how many years he's going to float on the work that he stumbled into 30, 40 years ago. Seems to me he owes Richard Nixon an apology, if that's his perspective. Because as Bob Woodward says, he was the commander-in-chief. He can do whatever he wants. If the president does it, it can't be illegal. So, thanks, Bob Woodward. Keep talking. Because eventually, maybe I'll get an apology from Carl Bernstein. All right, we're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll be talking to David Dan. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It is always a pleasure to welcome to this program David Dayen, who is now an independent journalist, and already, as far as I can tell, more prolific than any other journalist out there, has a piece coming up in a couple hours. We will link to it at majority.fm in the Pacific Standard on the wacky politics of the sequester. Welcome to the program, David. Welcome to the program, David.
Hello. Thank you.
Thank you. Let's go through just the sort of some of the mechanics. I mean, I've been talking about the sequester on this program for longer than anybody wants to hear about. But it's interesting because what we are seeing are reports from the White House and from, you know, agencies that are going to be affected by this, and cabinet officers who have officials who have portfolios that will be affected by this, in terms of what the implications of the sequester are going to be budgetarily. Walk us through this. We're talking about now, we've heard a bunch of different numbers. You know, first we hear $83 billion, and then some people say $44 billion. The number's actually somewhere in between in terms of its real impact from starting March 1st until the end of the year.
Yeah, I mean, prepare to get really nerdy here really quick.
That shan't be too hard.
The numbers of the sequester are, they'll nerd you out. Yes, the official number is that $85 billion in agency budgets must be cut between now and the end of the fiscal year, which is September 30th. In reality, because a lot of budgets are carried over from one year to the next, for example, transportation, if you authorize something now, you might not spend it until 2018. For that reason and others, CBO has estimated that you'll probably see about $44 billion in what they call outlays, which is cuts in the specific fiscal year. However, because those $44 billion are done over a seven-month period, it's not done over the entire fiscal year, but because we're already at near March 1st, it'll feel like more like an $80 billion cut. So all of this is to say that, yeah, $80 to $85 billion pretty much is what it's going to feel like to the economy, and the estimates are for the loss of close to 750,000 jobs and maybe a half a percentage off of GDP growth in 2013. But here's the very important point, is that these cuts are not going to feel terribly bad in the first month or so. And as much as the administration wants to make this a spectacular event, where long lines at the airport or meat shortages because of lack of inspectors or, you know, all of these things, maybe tax returns being delayed and refunds being delayed, because of sort of the normal machinations of the federal budget and rules governing it, you're probably not going to see a lot in the first month, and that's going to be very crucial to the public opinion aspect and the politics of the sequestration and federal spending cuts in general.
So, in other words, I mean, it's like turning a huge aircraft carrier in some way. It's a rather slow turn, or as this stuff sort of trickles down through the spending channels. Just to give folks a sense of the difficulty in even estimating what's going to happen when, the White House claims that Meals on Wheels, for instance, which is a program that is funded at least in part of by a broad range of federal programs, is going to mean that it's going to be a loss of 4 million meals. However, the Meals on Wheels people actually say it's going to be closer to 19 million meals. This is a program that basically provides one nutritious meal a day for low-income seniors. And so it's very difficult to sort of measure this. And I would imagine on top of that, that many of the programs that are going to feel the pinch at first are also ones that don't get a lot of attention from the media and are in their own sort of, for lack of a better term, sort of demographic and a silo in some ways.
Yeah, these are important points. The most important reason that you're not going to see big, showy, consumer-based, broad problems in the first month is that federal labor rules stipulate that you cannot furlough personnel, federal workers, without giving them 30 days notice and a 7-day appeal process. So that already kicks back any cuts in March into April as far as personnel is concerned. And personnel is where you're going to get these big, broad issues. That's where you're going to get issues with air traffic control, issues with TSA, issues with meat inspectors, things of that nature. And with respect to education, it's a completely different thing where everything's advance funded so that really, you, and Arne Duncan, the education secretary, has said that the real impact on the major budgets, Title I, Title II of the Elementary and Secondary Education Act, won't hit until next school year, until the 2013-2014 school year. So you really won't feel that until the summer. So as you say, for demographic reasons, you're going to see things like, you know, cuts to military readiness. And what does that really mean? Is maybe training will be a little bit deferred or things, or certain maintenance will be deferred. You're going to see things like cuts to maybe the R&D budget. Where you are going to see cuts, to immediate cuts, to things like long-term unemployment or things like the Women, Infant, and Children program. These are the largely voiceless communities, politically speaking, communities that are very vulnerable and don't have a lot of political power. So those big consumer-facing broad issues that you would see in a government shutdown, for example, just aren't going to be there in the first month or so. And that is going to completely change, because the whole idea from the aspect of the White House is that we're going to make these hurt and we're going to force Congress to, and Republicans in particular to have to come back and deal with this because it's going to be too much. They're going to get outcry from their constituents. And you're not going to see that in the first month. And that's going to completely change the politics of this entire thing.
And the paradox is that while we polls show us that Republicans will get the blame for this, the this in that sentence is unclear as to whether or not the country and this the Americans are actually going to, A, feel it in an acute sense, and also tie it into what is happening in Washington.
Exactly. I mean, that is a very critical point here, that even though you see poll after poll showing that people don't want these budget cuts, they're opposed to the idea of them, the media right now is facing, and there are a lot of great local stories about how this will affect you and your community. You're seeing that in almost every community in the nation. And right now, that is kind of changing public opinion a little bit. But if for a month those things don't really come to pass in a very tangible way, you're going to see that opinion backslide. And it there's also the point that on March 27th, the continuing resolution to fund the entire government runs out. And you could see these two things sort of merge into one another, where there's a resolution to not let the government shut down, but it will sort of incorporate the sequestration cuts into the new total budget number, essentially. So you could see that happen, and then the cuts sort of just get absorbed, and we just get a lower level of services, and you might not even see the furloughs at that point. So it's very, very hard to predict what's going to happen politically, even though the White House has this idea that this will be like the 95 shutdown, and you present all of these problems with cutting federal spending to the public, and the public will rebel. Well, it just might not be that simple.
Yeah, I want to talk about the continuing resolution in a sec, but what strikes me about this is that on one hand, we had the president attempting to forge a grand bargain, which I still think is in play, and we can talk about that. But one of the dynamics about the grand bargain that was so repellent, aside from the actual cutting of basically your and my Social Security in particular, as guys of our age, and the raising of Medicare eligibility age, was that the whole plan by those who fetishize a grand bargain is that if we put these cuts so far in the future, they are severed from the act of making those cuts. The implications, I should say, of those cuts are severed from the act of making those cuts, and therefore are more politically palatable, because how do people who are in their 40s now go and complain about their Social Security cuts, or their 50s, early 50s now, complain about their Social Security cuts that happened 20 years earlier? We have a sort of a mini version of that dynamic now with the sequester, except for it cuts against those of us who want to say, and those of us who at least are hoping. I mean, I would hope that we wouldn't do any cuts, but to the extent that it appears that we might be, or that we are, I would want it to be a teachable moment insofar as, hey, you get what you pay for, and you want these things, and it's worth it for you to pay for them.
Right. I mean, the other problem, I think, with making this a teachable moment is that the official position from the White House is that not that we need to cancel these cuts,
right,
that we need to continue funding at current levels, if not higher levels, because public investment has multiple rewards, and especially where we're at with a fragile recovery, you need more spending, more circulation of money into the economy. Their official position is that we need a balanced solution, which will include, you know, the same level of deficit reduction, really the same level of austerity, if you want to put it that way, just in a smarter way that may not have as harmful effects at the micro level. But at the macro level, you're talking about the same level of cuts. So what is the teachable moment here? The teachable moment should be federal spending is valuable and needed and necessary. It shouldn't be that federal spending is not that valuable, but some of it is, and if you balance a solution together, you can make all the cuts that you want. I think that's a tension within this whole discussion as well. I mean, in Washington, the only people that have said, let's go ahead and cancel the sequester, has been the Congressional Progressive Caucus, and they didn't do it until yesterday. So there's been – that voice has not been in the debate whatsoever, and that's a huge problem, especially because this is not going to really look that bad in the first month and a half.
All right, and I want to make sure that people understand here that there are two elements to the implications of these cuts. One is the diminishment of services, and two is, at a time of weak private economic activity, we need the government to run big deficits in order to fill that output gap. So we have two implications here. One is a services implication. The other implication is to the effect on the whole economy. So even if you have a so-called balanced approach where you are still impacting the economy in the same way.
Absolutely, and that's especially true because this comes on top of a significant amount of austerity that's been put in for 2013. You know, the reversal of the payroll tax cut immediately lowered salaries, had the effect of lowering salaries of every worker, everyone who earns income by 2%. You had various other things out of the fiscal cliff deal that ended up creating austerity, mostly on the tax side. And so if you combine that with what the sequester is going to bring you, you're talking about a fiscal drag from the federal government of anywhere between 1.5 and 2 percentage points of GDP. I mean, we're just not generating that much economic output to withstand that. I don't know if it's going to be a double-dip recession. There's varying reports, but certainly you will see an extremely sluggish economic growth, probably no change, if not a backslide in the unemployment rate. And we just can't afford this right now when we are still recovering. We still have a huge gap in terms of employment from the peaks of the pre-recession years. And this is just not the time to do this.
What strikes me about the whole debate about who's responsible for this, I mean, because obviously everyone, you know, in Congress, frankly, not everyone, but mostly at least the broad leadership of Congress and the president, highly all responsible for this coming to this point. But it strikes me as some vindication for those of us who were saying in 2010 and early 2011, in 2009, for that matter, that this talk of austerity, this talk of deficit reduction was going to come back and bite people in the ass. I mean, you know, and I belabored this point on this program, but the failure to say in the context of even the stimulus, if it was locked in, there was no way that President Obama could get any more of the stimulus because of a couple of senators here or there. The failure to say this is not going to be enough, to start that argument then, is what has led us to this point now.
I think that's a critical point. I think Kevin Drum, it was, had a post a couple of days ago where he just went back to 2010 and he looked at all of the deficit reduction that has been done since then, since President Obama made a very celebrated pivot to deficit reduction. This was when Democrats still controlled Congress, by the way, both houses. And Obama made this big pivot saying that we have to get our fiscal house in order. And since that time, we've basically cut about $3.6 trillion. If you look at everything, if you look at the fiscal cliff deal, if you look at the 2011 budget cuts, if you look fiscal year 2011, if you look at the Budget Control Act, which was the debt limit deal, and if you look at the sequester, if you put it all together and you include the savings to interest on the debt, it's about $3.6 trillion, which is about 90% of what the big number everyone was saying at the time, which was we need to cut budgets by $4 trillion. So everybody that says, well, yes, we flirted with deficit reduction, but we have managed it, we haven't done as much austerity as they have, say, in Europe, well, we're getting to the point where that pivot to deficit reduction had huge consequences for huge amounts of spending coming out of the economy and huge increases in taxes as well. Not huge, but at least some of them. That is basically, it became a self-fulfilling prophecy. As soon as that pivot happened, as soon as that became the dominant conversation in Washington, eventually, sooner or later, by hook or by crook, this was going to get done. And it did. And it had massive knock-on effects for the economy, for the long-term unemployed, who would otherwise we'd be in much better shape economically today. We didn't have this conversation, and we didn't end up taking $3.6 trillion out of the economy over a period of several years.
And I think yesterday we found a poll that said something like, 7% of the country is aware that we have cut, maybe it's 6% of the country is aware that we have cut deficits and in a greater and more rapid amount than we have in 70 years over the past three.
Right.
So let's talk a little bit about this continuing resolution. Just tell us a little bit about what that is, because I think this is the end game, right? I mean, I think it seems to me that I have no sense of what the administration is trying to do here politically, but it seems to me that the idea is that you keep talking about these cuts. People start to sense that they're happening over the next 30 days. I mean, I'm not as convinced, frankly, that the implications of the sequester are going to be considered a dud by the population, because I don't think the population really in general is even aware of the sequester, knows what it means, you know, and I think it's 30 days.
Right, but I mean, the ways it would get them to know what it means would be if they go to an airport and there's a three-hour wait to go through the security line, or if they go to the grocery store and there's no ground beef because meat inspectors can't inspect the beef at the point of sale. So, but those things won't happen. They won't happen in the first month. They certainly won't happen between now and March 27th. And that's when the authorization for funding the entire federal government ends. And a deal must be made within Congress to either have another continuing resolution or finish out the fiscal year with an appropriation.
So what do you think is going to happen there? I mean, because I am of the mind that, look, everybody in the media is going to be looking for these stories on what has been cut. And so we're going to see these stories, and people may not experience it firsthand in the first 30 days, because that's what we're talking about, right? Until March 27th, we're 30 days away from that. People aren't going to feel these things in the first 30 days, but they're going to be aware that it's happening. It's going to be like a train coming down the tracks, and then the train could very well arrive. And it seems to me that if the administration is looking for this to generate the popular pushback that they want, that they're going to wait until this continuing resolution, and this is when we could have a real showdown, and when we may actually see Republican intransigence push a government shutdown. Because people have to remember that the Republicans in Congress, like 97% of them, I don't know, some ungodly high number, all came from red districts, from Mitt Romney districts here. And so their political incentive structure is different from the rest of normal people's, essentially, which is I've got to play to the basiest of the base of my party.
Right. You would think with the strategy that they appear to be on right now, the only way for the White House to really reap the rewards, to show the effects of austerity in service to reversing it, would be to shut down the government, would be to say, essentially, you need to fund everything at a certain level, you need to add taxes or whatever, and if not, we're not signing the document. And then shut it down and then see what happens after that. I'm just not sure that's really the trajectory they want to be on. I'm not sure that's trajectory members of Congress who are up for election in 2 years want to be on. And it's unclear to me where we will land. But the reporting has said that if it's over the next 3 or 4 weeks while we lead up to this continuing resolution deadline, that the sequester really isn't doing a whole lot, that Congress might authorize a bill that would keep spending at the same level, incorporate the sequester, and therefore give agencies more discretion at their level to mitigate the effects. In other words, they wouldn't have to cut across the board 9% or 10% or whatever it is, each individual program. They would have discretion to say, okay, we're going to put money into this and we're going to cancel this program and things of that nature. That's what's being talked about, and the administration would have to then affirmatively basically cancel that. And veto that. And I'm not sure that they're necessarily going to be in the political position on March 27th to do that. And that's because of the slow walk of the sequester. By the way, another reason that the sequester could be slow walked is that agency managers do have limited discretion inside that first month, perhaps, to shuffle things around, use unobligated funds, use carryover funds, use things that will prolong or delay the pain, and agency managers want to do that because they want to serve their mission, and they want to protect their workforce. So why wouldn't they do that, especially if they think maybe a solution will come down the road that'll make it easier on them.
Right.
So I just don't think there's going to be a lot to, that you'll see and feel in the first month. And for that reason, it's going to be hard for the Obama administration to make that really hard stance on a government shutdown on March 27th. But I could be wrong.
Yeah, I think it's a very tough call because, you know, so much of this is going to be driven by what the story the media wants to project, I think.
And what we know is that the media, writ large, has some sort of internal bias towards the efficacy of budget cuts.
Right.
I mean, this has been a story over the last 2 years. The sort of deficit caucus begins and ends inside the Beltway with the traditional media. So what story are they going to want to tell? Well, the budget cuts happened and they were a big nothing. I mean, I could totally see that being the narrative over that month of March. And that's going to be very difficult for the administration.
Yeah, it's going to be interesting. I got to say, I'm a little skeptical about that because that's a very boring story to tell. And, you know, to a certain extent, there is that tendency in the media to want to tell a story. And so
sure.
it's going to be fascinating to see how this works.
I mean, I don't disagree. Right. I don't disagree that they won't want to sensationalize, you know, what's happening. I mean, they've certainly done so over the past couple weeks. But first of all, I've already seen things out there like, oh, the sequester is bad for web traffic. So maybe they'd just ignore the whole thing and find another thing to work on. Number one. Number two, I do think if there's really nothing, no evidence that this has dribbled down to the individual level and that there's just nothing, no story to tell, then they either A, won't tell it, or B, tell this kind of counter narrative story about how everybody said that budget cuts were terrible, but look, it wasn't that big a deal. I mean, I can totally see that happen.
Interesting. Well, David, thank you for talking to us about this. We will link to your
sure.
piece in the Pacific Standard and check in with you over the coming weeks to get your sense of how this is playing out in D.C. It's obviously it's obviously hugely important to the future of the country, particularly in the short and midterm in terms of our economy. And for people, you know, we've got people unemployment insurance. It's one of those things that people are going to feel. But again, it's also one of those groups of people that few people pay attention to in terms of our politics yeah. and our media. And if they did, you know, we wouldn't have 99ers, essentially. But
just to add one last thing,
please,
Sam, is that this is about the long term of how we organize society in many respects, because if these budget cuts are somehow seen by the public as palatable, if the sequester is seen as something that people can live with, that they're getting comfortable with, the politics of federal spending cuts completely changes. The theory is that everyone likes to talk about cutting the deficit, but then you can't really do it because you hurt somebody. If the idea here or the position becomes cemented that, oh, nobody really got hurt, that completely changes where public investment will be over the next 10, 20 years. And right now it's at the lowest level since the Eisenhower administration. So this is hugely important. And it's a really high-stakes game that the administration and that the Democrats are playing. And I'm not sure that sort of reality is going to comply with what they want to get out of it.
One more last point too, because this is important in terms of the chess game that's being played here. There are many who read Atreos is one of these people. Jonathan Chait wrote something about this recently too. That and just to include a sort of a fairly broad spectrum on the at least on the. On the liberal spectrum, as it were, that the one motivating factor of Republicans ultimately at the end of the day is they don't want taxes on wealthy people. And that the idea of cutting Social Security, the idea of cutting Medicare, the idea of shrinking government, et cetera, the idea of cutting deficits, et cetera, are all secondary to their desire not to have taxes on wealthy people. And as such, the reason why Democrats should or do simply draw the line in the sand in more revenues, as you know, taking a balanced approach, is because they know this is a poison pill that the Republicans can never get to that table, because they can they will never raise it. So as much as they want to cut Social Security, or don't, you know, or have no problem with it, or as much as they want to shrink the deficit, that it is all secondary to their desire not to raise taxes on rich people. And therefore, the Democrats go in and say, we want a balanced approach. We'll do all those things that people perceive that you want to do, as long as you raise taxes on wealthy people by cutting loopholes or whatever it is. That's the poison pill. Just give me your thoughts on that dynamic.
Well, I agree with that analysis. In this case, if you believe that Republicans will never agree to these sort of poison pill revenue increases, which they just agreed to, by the way, 8 weeks ago. But
in that situation, they had no choice. I mean,
they had no choice. But here's my point: is that if you believe that that's going to happen, that they'll never agree to it, then what you're saying is that these sequester cuts will just roll out because Democrats aren't offering anything other than this balanced approach. Because if anyone believes in deficit reduction, it's mainstream Democrats. We've seen that since the Clinton administration. So if their gambit is to get Republicans to agree to revenue increases, and Republicans can agree to revenue increases, then this is just going to roll out. And that's a bad thing,
right?
Empirically, for the economy. And so no one is making the argument that, well, we don't need a balanced approach. We need to cancel this very destructive thing that everyone agrees is going to be a catastrophe for our economy. And too few people are saying that right now, and I think Democrats are too caught up in this gamesmanship over revenues to actually do what's right for our economy.
I agree. I mean, there has to be a way of playing both those games, at least to a certain extent. But we need a lot more of this cancel the whole sequester thing. But we're not seeing it. All right, David Dayan, thanks again so much. Always a pleasure.
Thanks a lot.
All right, folks. Again, as a programming note today, for our members, we will be going a little bit short, but we will have another interview for you, something, a preview, if you will, of an interview you'll hear if you listen to Ring of Fire Radio this weekend that I did with Tina Dupuy on the reason why gun manufacturers have a unique release and gun sellers have a unique release from liability for the damage their products do and for the externalities that all of society ends up covering the costs. It's literally millions of dollars, billions of dollars a year that we pay as taxpayers to deal with the implications of their products being used essentially in the fashion they were designed to be used for. That will be for members. In the meantime, said this at the beginning of the show, on this program, as you know, we take a lot of phone calls from libertarians, self-proclaimed libertarians, Ron Paulites, Alex Jonesites, Glenn Beckianites. They all seem to call themselves libertarians in one fashion or another. Who knows? I've had debates with Lee Doran, who's sort of a Republican libertarian, I guess, or Stefan Molyneux, who is a philosophical libertarian who apparently the answer to everything from that philosophical libertarian is to simply had something to do with like making sure that everybody raises their kids well, I think was ultimately the key that unlocked the future happy society that we're going to get with libertarianism. So I'm always curious. I mean, we get a lot of this. I think this is actually an increasingly growing movement amongst the youth. I don't know the scope of it. I don't know how lasting it will be. There are obviously some aspects of libertarianism that are attractive for good reason. There is a desire not to have an imperial United States. There is a, well, ostensibly, I mean, as we've taken, I would say, dozens, if not nearly 100 phone calls, probably 100 phone calls, maybe more, actually, over the past 2 years from libertarians. Not one of them has ever called in to talk about and complain about what I perceive as to be legitimate civil or any civil liberties. Very legitimate complaints about what the Obama administration has done in terms of civil liberties. Not one of them has ever done that. They've talked about the fear that we're losing our rights to purchase incandescent light bulbs or to buy motor vehicles that who may be less expensive because their gas tanks explode. We've heard
the fact that you can't pick and choose who enters your establishment.
Yeah, we've heard that it's problematic that I don't have the right to discriminate, even though I would never personally, but that people should have the right to have racial preferences for certain people who enter into their restaurant. We've heard all of these things.
We've also heard reinstituting slavery. I think that's another important one to have.
I don't remember that one.
If a state wants to.
Well, yeah.
You remember that call?
Yes, yes. And yes. And so all sorts of talk about how the federal government is bad, but if the state government does the same thing, it's fine because it's in line with what this person thinks that one of the founding fathers thought at 3 a.m. when they were, I don't know, brushing their wooden teeth. I have no idea. But so I'm always on the lookout as to whether or not this philosophy permeates the mainstream media. And we saw some of this craziness permeate the mainstream media in the form of Alex Jones going on the Piers Morgan show, which was, you know, this is a sideshow. It's a carnival for the two of them. But it seems that this gun control debate, you know, I don't know if that's the term of art these days, gun control. I think some people are like, I don't know what it means. There's another term that people are using now, like just sensible gun reform. It doesn't matter. And we've had people like this call this program talking about the New York State gun laws are problematic because it creates a slippery slope. It creates a slippery slope. There's a slippery slope that's being created when you say in New York State that you cannot own a military-grade automatic weapon. That creates a slippery slope. Now, I happen to be aware of two Supreme Court cases, including Heller, that have been decided in 2008 and 2010, that, as much as I don't necessarily like it, affirm that there is an individual right to bear arms. I know some of you strict constructionists and textualists and originalists will say, hey, wait a second. It doesn't say that in the in the Constitution. It says for a well-regulated militia to have the rights to bear arms. But come on, don't go all Scalia on me, except for when Scalia talks about it. But so the idea of a slippery slope is impossible in this regard unless we're able to get a new set of Supreme Court justices, or at least two or three ones to replace the right-wing block of five, maybe one or two for that matter. So the slippery slope argument is sort of a joke, but we see it revived in one of the two clips that we're going to play for you in a moment. Piers Morgan last night, I'm not a huge fan of Piers Morgan, but my sister apparently somewhere in her travels was watching it and she texted me. And I watch these news programs online in a special streaming site that I am not aware of. And it lags a little bit behind, so I was able to catch most of this interview. Apparently, there's a guy who, and what state is he in? Do we know? I don't know where this guy was and what state it was. But here's Piers Morgan interviewing a young man who, by the fact in this shot, we can see in the background a big Ron Paul banner. Ron Paulite banner appears to be a Ron Paulite. He also is the proprietor of a pizza restaurant, which, as far as I can tell from the pictures,
it is all around pizza and deli from Virginia Beach, Virginia.
Okay, so all around pizza deli in Virginia Beach, Virginia Beach, Virginia. As far as I can tell, the pizza, the crust is a little bit thick for my tastes. But that's not the point here. He has started a promotion where if you wear your gun into the establishment, you get 15 or 20% off of your too big crust size pizza. And here's Piers Morgan asking him in this first clip as to why he's doing this. Here it is.
Right, but why do you want your pizzeria full of people armed to the teeth?
It actually makes me feel more safe.
Why?
It makes me feel more safe because these are responsible people. And if a criminal decides to do anything funny, I have these people to back me up.
How do you know the people that have come in to get your discount aren't mentally ill or criminals?
I guess because they can walk in on their own 2 feet and they drove here.
So people who can walk on their own 2 feet and who can drive a car are not mentally ill or criminals?
They're innocent until they're proven guilty.
Oh, sorry, folks. But we have been listening to that clip for quite some time in the office, and
Mr. Lays of this pizzeria, please call into our show.
I'm not convinced he hasn't. So the criminals won't try anything funny because they've driven there or they walk in on their own 2 feet.
Only.
Oh wait, they.
Only so, the handicapped are criminals.
Apparently, this guy has some very interesting theories on criminology that he is sharing on TV. And now, why he didn't just say, like, I'm just trying to make a point, solidarity with people who are willing to bring guns into my pizzeria, and it was a stunt. I mean, I don't know why, because, now I'll tell you why he didn't say it. Because he has been indoctrinated and believes these things. And then, I think, I don't know if this is the first time Piers Morgan has been aware of what actually is the subtext of what goes on with these people's minds. But Piers Morgan continues on with this interview after the proprietor of Virginia Beach Pizza and Gun Emporium, I guess, after the guy tells him that, well, having people in my shop with guns makes me feel more safe because no criminals can come in and do anything funny. And after saying, I know they're not criminals because they walk in with their own 2 feet or drive here. Apparently criminals have one of those things that they can just appear in pizza restaurants without actually traveling by foot or by, maybe criminals take horses in Virginia. I don't know. But then Piers Morgan asked him, what is it that you're really afraid of? And here's where the guy talks about the slippery slope, which of course we know is a joke. But listen to where this goes, folks, because this is a real belief system that is out there, and I don't think it's just a function of pizza owners in Virginia. Play this clip.
I want to take away the guns.
Not one of them involves confiscation.
Future presidents might want to take away our guns.
You are quite happy for American civilians to march into your restaurant with rocket launchers arriving in armed tanks and perhaps carrying a few Uzi submachine guns. Is that your position?
Well, the thing is, I don't trust our government, and they out firepower we the people, even with the weapons that we have right now that are legal. If they were decided to wage war on the people itself, we would lose in a heartbeat.
Pause it. Okay, so now if the idea is that we already are outgunned by the government and we the people would lose in a heartbeat and if we only had shotguns, right now we're already outgunned, well then what difference is it going to make? You just want it to be a close fight? Ultimately, we're all going to die. But at least we put up a good fight. With a shotgun, we would just, we'd be taken out after only taking out two or three of them. Right? I mean, presumably, the, whoever it is that's going to come and get this guy at the pizza place is probably his neighbors. Right? Who? But those are the neighbors who have signed up for the government force. But you see, it's not really the U.S. government that we have to be afraid of.
And now they want us just to have shotguns. That makes it even easier for them to do what they want. Now,
right, so what you're saying is that the... Okay, let me clarify again, because it's important to understand what you're saying. You believe that your government, current President Barack Obama, may well attack its own people. How are they going to do that? With the American military or without the American military?
Well, it really isn't our government that I'm worried about. It's something bigger than... Our government is the United Nations.
Okay, now, so the United Nations is about to attack American people. Which part of the United Nations do you think is about to launch an attack on the greatest military power that the planet Earth has ever seen, that has 5,000 nuclear warheads? Which part of the world do you imagine is right now marshalling its troops to invade America?
I'm not saying they are going to do that. I'm saying we need the Second Amendment as insurance against... them trying anything funny.
There you go. You don't want the UN to try anything funny because they come across like they're comedians, like they're just trying to be funny, but then they come and they take over our country. So what, well, I mean, let me just give you a scenario of how this works, okay? What the UN does is they have a huge parking lot on First Avenue in the in New York City. It's a deep underground parking lot. What they will do is they will smuggle in blue-helmeted soldiers from all the other countries involved in the UN into that parking lot and then slowly unleash them as if they're all going on a comedy tour. It's going to be like, you know, blue helmet comedy tour, and they're going to go around trying to do something funny. But what they're really going to be doing is they're going to be attacking you, and that's why you got to be armed to the hilt. Now, as soon as we get rid of the Second Amendment, this is when the plan goes into effect. So, folks, I'm telling you right now, when you see any type of gun control, keep your eyes open for any type of strange comedy tour with comedians that you're like, hey, how is it these guys are going on such a barnstorming tour? That's going to be the signal. When you see that, contact me at this program, majorityreporters@gmail.com. I'll give you further instructions then.
The Blue Helmet comedy tour, that's well done right there.
There you go.
Jamie Foxtrot.
The other thing that's so impressive is that UN does things like not have the power to have us pay their bills and all these really devious things where they look like they're basically an international laughing stock.
Uh-huh.
Nobody follows anything they say.
Uh-huh.
And that all, because it's sort of funny.
You're getting sleepy. You're getting UN sleepy.
This guy is worried about the UN until he needs them to get allaroundpizza.com back from those cyber squatters.
First they came for my pizza. And by the time they came for me, there was no fast food left to protect me. All right, folks. That is our program for today. You can support this show by becoming a member at majority.fm. JustCoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Organic, if you want it, coupon code 10%. Use the word majority. Members, stick around. We'll have another interview for you with Tina Dupuy. And we'll be back live tomorrow.